Episode 287 of the Pilot to Pilot podcast takes off now. Fly with Garmin Avionics, then grab your mobile device and make the Garmin Pilot app your cockpit companion. Get advanced functions you'll use before, during, and after every flight, including updating your aircraft's databases and logging engine data. Plan, file, fly, log with Garmin Pilot. The Pilot to Pilot podcast is brought to you by Learn the Finer Points. Use the link below to save 10% off their ground school app. Aviation, there's a new offer from SiriusXM. Make sure you upgrade your next flight without upgrading your plane by getting the Garmin GDL52 portable receiver. The GDL52 has ADS-B traffic and weather, plus SiriusXM weather and entertainment. It has Bluetooth and works with Garmin Pilot apps. For a limited time, you can get a $300 rebate on the GDL52, plus it comes with a free 3-month trial of SiriusXM's weather and entertainment. I love flying with SiriusXM, and it's honestly one of my favorite features about having the G5000, so the GDL52 will offer you a very similar outlook on the weather and also getting to listen to some awesome radio stations on SiriusXM. So check out the GDL52 at aopa.org/SiriusXM.
My name is Andrew Ross. I'm with Vath Publishing, which has published the Airline Transition Manual. I was one of the co-authors of that. For my day job, I'm a pilot at a major U.S. carrier based out of Chicago, Illinois, flying the Boeing 787 all over the world. Very much enjoy that. And on top of that, I'm also doing some volunteer work with the nonprofit association, the National Intercollegiate Flying Association, which hosts collegiate flight competitions all over the country, as well as doing some pilot union work for my carrier as well.
Avi Nation, what is going on? And welcome back to the Pilot Podcast. My name is Justin Seams, and I am your host. Today's episode is with Andrew, who has created or is part of a team that created the Airline Transition Manual. Now, you might be saying, how can someone write a manual like this? Well, he has tons of experience in aviation, is currently a major airline pilot, and talking to him, this book seems like it is very, very needed. So if you're new to the industry, if you're new to the airline world, this might be a book you need to check out. It's also a great conversation that we have. We talk about many factors of aviation, how he got to where he is today, and of course, we touch on the Airline Transition Manual. If you want to buy one, there should be a link below so you can check it out. Aviation, thank you so much for listening to today's episode. We appreciate it. And if you want to show your support, you can go to Bold Aviator. They make the best aviation gear. And of course, they make the Pilot hat. So go ahead and check that out at the link below as well. I don't want to take you much any more of your time. So without any further ado, here's Andrew from the Airline Transition Manual. Andrew, welcome to the podcast. I'm excited to have you on. 787 was probably my favorite airliner until I got to fly in a 350 and saw the 350. I think the 350 might have beaten it out for me. So I do apologize ahead of time. It has now been kicked to the bottom, not the bottom, just number two. So it's still up there, but you know, side stick, tray table, what are you going to do, right?
I am very disappointed that I still, even after, you know, 10,000 hours of flying, that I still have to like weasel my little tray of food in between a yoke and everything else. And yeah, the 350, there's rumors about it possibly coming to my airline. I don't know if that's going to ever happen, because the problem, this is, and now we're going to get into Boeing versus Airbus, but Boeing doesn't have a 777-200 replacement. And that's a very big issue, because even the X model that's coming out, the 8-9, that's a 300 and like a slightly larger 300 replacement. So there's nothing to replace. That's the 78-10 gets a little bit close to it, but I don't know what's going to really the 350 is the only thing that replaces it. So there is, I will say that they're, that both airplanes are impressive accomplishments of engineering, and both do similar but different things. And the 350 is just bigger at the end of the day. It's a huge airplane. So I do want to, maybe I'll get the chance to fly it one day.
Maybe, you never know. But Boeing seems like, we're not going to bash on Boeing the whole time. So if you're at Boeing, I'm sorry, but they seem to not have replacements for any kind of airplanes. You know, the 75, maybe the 76-ish, you know, like those are some old airframes. So we need that, 797, whatever they're supposed to be calling it. Clock's ticking, right?
The 7X, you know, they always start with the 7X, but you're right. And I was flying the 757, 767 before this, and that airplane was my favorite airplane. I, you know, doesn't take much for me to fall in love, I guess. I flew an Embraer 145 before that. Love that airplane.
Everything you say from here on out doesn't matter right, anymore. You love the 145. We're good. See you later.
From a pilot perspective, it was great. I have been in the back plenty, so I do feel for everybody. But the front of the plane was amazing. And then the 757, 767 was incredible. But you're right. They just don't. They keep filling a spot that's there. Like the 78-8 is probably the closest to the 76 that they're going to get, and then it just gets bigger from there. But the incredible part, having flown the 76 and the 78, the 76 and the 78 at the 300 and then the 78-8 burn the same amount of fuel, but I'm going Mach 8.6 and carrying about 50 more people than the 76-300. That's all that fuel efficiency. It's incredible. Like, and that's part of the marvel of that machine. It flies faster, burns less fuel, and carries more people. And that's the name of the game in economics. So
I know, it's crazy. We're getting about to the end of how much I can talk about airliners, because I am a corporate guy, right? So fractional side, corporate side, I fly small planes. It is what it is. Someone's got to do it. But all I know is 787, cool. 350, cool. Everything else, meh. So that's where I stand.
Fair.
And if I'm on a plane, if it's a commuter, or not even a commuter, yeah, I guess a commuter, 175, I'll be happy. Give me an Embraer 175.
Yeah.
Oh, can never be happier. Even in economy, I don't even need a first class upgrade. I'll just sit in economy, be perfectly fine. But we're not here to talk about airliners, like I said. We are here to talk about you, talk about your story, and talk about a book and the tool that you have with a lot of common questions. And we'll get into it later, but one of the podcasts I had, they said they had no idea how to transition to the airline world. So it's very timely and it's very good because, everyone is hiring like crazy. So there's a lot of people probably searching for what you have created. But we'll get there eventually. I want to talk about you and why you became a pilot. So first thing I always ask everyone is, why did you get in aviation? What was the original inspiration?
So the original inspiration is sort of twofold. I grew up in the Chicago area in the west suburbs, specifically right under the O'Hare approach path. So it was always something forever in my field of view, look up, see a big airplane coming into O'Hare. Ooh, wow, cool. But I think what really hooked me was going to, my extended family is mostly in Ohio. And for a long time, my mom would be the primary one that would take us back and forth to Ohio to visit them. And it was traveling with two small kids was not fun over a long stretch of time. So it'll take an 8-hour drive, take a 1-hour flight. So we started flying back and forth to Columbus from Midway. And Midway, if every aviation enthusiast knows, driving around Midway is really cool because you get right up to, like 1,000 feet from where the runway starts. And back when I was a kid, that wasn't a sealed in fence. You had just chain link with barbed wire on it. So you could watch the entire thing happen. And having airplanes fly landing or taking off over, the noise, the power, it was incredible. It was awesome. And those trips started getting me really into it. I had nobody in my family that was in aviation at all. Not even in management anywhere. Nobody did anything. So for a while, it wasn't really something that I thought was accessible. I just thought, oh, well, that's really cool. That's something that somebody does. But it was never for me. I was going to go be an architect, which is also not something anybody in my family had done. But I liked drawing like schematics and stuff like that when I was a kid. And so around my middle school age, my mom and dad asked, my mom specifically, we were driving by Schaumburg Airport and we see a little small airplane. She goes, would you be interested in, flying a small airplane? I said, nah, if I do go that route, I'm just going to fly jets, middle school.
That's just how it works.
That's just how it works, right? Skip the small planes. Then in high school, I was offered the Southern Illinois University, where I went to school, back in 2000s, had a career fair that was corporate. It was actually Corporate Aviation Day. And what happened is they had some alumni and some connections within the industry that would fly down Gulfstreams, Hawkers, King Airs, anything in the area. I think the state brought their King Air 350 down at one point. And their career day would be talking about aviation. And then we would talk about the program and how to become a pilot and all that stuff. And that happened my sophomore year of high school. And that's when the light really clicked on, oh, this is something that I can do. This is really like accessible. This is this is, and now I know the career path, or I know how to get to where I want to be. So from a very young age, and I know you're, I'm talking to the corporate pilot, you know, and from a very early age, that was my career track, was corporate aviation. And I'll talk about that in a little bit here. So we did, I came back, and I think my junior year summer, so it took another year, and I went to another career day after that. I took over the summer of 2013, I took my first flying lesson, or 2003, I took my first flying lesson, and then started working my way to my private throughout my senior year, and culminated in getting my private 2 weeks before going to school. And that kind of sealed. That was everything. Like it was between SIU and Lewis University, and SIU, my instructor, my primary instructor, who always has, you know, the outsized impact on all of us, was a Southern Illinois grad. And that kind of sealed it for me. I was going to go to SIU. So that's kind of, and then I got all my other ratings there. So that's kind of how I got my start. But I was definitely, all through high school, even before I started flight training, I was the friend who was driving the car that everybody started screaming in fear at whenever we passed by an airport, because I'd be like, no, yes, I'm looking over there, not paying attention. Like, I didn't have my instrument rating then. I couldn't cross check very well. Yeah. You know, I'm just swerving onto oncoming traffic and stuff.
Yeah, but why not? You're fine.
But that, yeah. So
they'll get out of your way, right?
Yeah, right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Their self-preservation is like mine. They'll dodge me.
Yeah, you'll be fine.
Yeah. So that's kind of how that started and evolved.
Yeah. Well, that's really interesting. Did you grow up on the east side or the west side? Or I guess of O'Hare. So east of O'Hare or west of O'Hare?
West of O'Hare. Okay, so got it. We were about as far out of suburbia before you transition into farmland.
Okay, got it. Like Wheaton, Geneva, like that area?
Even a little further, Elgin, Bartlett, Elgin area. So
you live in like Iowa, essentially. You're not even in
Basically,
Illinois.
Basically, yeah. I mean, I may as well be Moline, yeah.
Yeah, right? You're not from Illinois. You can't say Chicago.
No. That's not funny. The state of Chicago.
Yeah. So being the first person in your family to kind of go through aviation, and it sounded like your mom and your parents, they're very supportive about it, right? She was like, hey, do you want to fly small planes? Like, what is that, something of interest? What was the barrier, if there was one, maybe there wasn't, of being the first one? Like, obviously, expense, like how expensive it is. The people think aviation just is inherently dangerous and you're going to die in a plane crash. Just talk a little bit about either like the convincing that needed to happen for yourself, for your family, to get into the industry and even to start your training.
I cannot talk about what my parents may have felt when I started, but I think what I did is I called them on a statement that they had always told my sister and I growing up, which was, it doesn't matter what you do, pick what you're passionate about and what you enjoy, and everything else will fall into place. They were both in careers that they didn't particularly enjoy, and that really had an outsized impact on them when they came to telling my sister and I what we wanted to do. Like, they'll take care of it to a certain extent, or they'll help us get, and they dedicated themselves to doing whatever it took to get us to attain our dreams, which the older and older I get, and the more, you know, other things that I'm involved in, I realized how that is very much not an easy stance to take when you're dealing with, you know, your children, or you're dealing with somebody you love. It's actually a very, very difficult thing to say to somebody when you think that they might be doing something that's hurting their lives or could hurt their lives or their careers or something like that. Then at the time when I decided I wanted to go in aviation, airlines were making, you know, what, $20,000 a year. We definitely weren't going into it for the glory and the money. So at the beginning of it, and I would say they were very anxious about it, because they didn't know, right? Like you said, they didn't understand. It was an unknown. But they knew that in order to find what motivated me and what unlocked whatever potential I had, they had to just let that go. So if they were overly concerned about it, they very, very much sheltered me from that fear. And I guess that probably helped me. They also had a lot of faith in me to do what was right. So I guess a little bit of that, it could be they had no concern about it, but I know my parents, and I know they did have concerns about it. They just did a great job.
They just didn't care about you. They're like, whatever happens, yeah, happens. Like, yeah.
Whatever. He's not our favorite anyways. We got another one. Yeah. Let him go out.
No one expected anything out of him anyways. So we'll be all
right. Right. Yeah. No, that's a funny story too. And I'm sure that one probably isn't far off from accurate, because I was not motivated in high school at all. Like I think I had a, a 2.3 GPA before I found flying. And that was just because I didn't care. I was like, ah, whatever. Like I didn't, it wasn't, I can't say that I had a learning disability. I'm not dyslexic. I just didn't care. I just did. I had no passion in school. I thought that it was a very boring exercise. And it was just something to complete to get to friends in video games, you know? And that's kind of finding that purpose really kind of changed my trajectory significantly on how I valued school and schoolwork. So
I would say,
I think there was, oh, go ahead.
No, keep going.
Oh, I was going to say that probably, you know, and again, in hindsight, the older I get, and I tell this often that I probably wasn't a great investment on paper because of that. Like, you know, you want me to pay $150 per hour to train you and you don't even like math and the science? Like, how am I going to, why am I, and don't you need to know math, right? The old adage, oh, you're a pilot, you must be really good at math. I'm pretty good at percentages and I'm pretty good at, you know, poker, but I don't know if I'm really good at math. Like I'm not going to figure out if we start falling from 35,000 feet, what our, you know, terminal velocity is going to be from this altitude. I'm just not going to figure that out. But so yeah, I would say that was more than the concern of me piloting an airplane. It was that I would say probably was more of a factor of, well, are you really going to take it seriously? And I did.
Were you like looking back when you started? So someone that maybe isn't trying hard, doesn't care. I mean, this might not be you, but maybe you didn't have the confidence going into it, thinking that you could actually do it. Was there a doubt that like, I just can't do this, I'm not smart enough in yourself? Or once that passion truly hit, did you just kind of hit the ground running and not even think twice about what you're doing? You're just like, I just like this. I can do this all day.
It's a phenomenal question. I don't think I realized at the time how consequential my grade point average was until I found this. I didn't ever believe I was not capable of something. It was simply, I never, when I got the report card, I went, good, I'm not failing. And I kind of gave it, you know, to the parents. And that was literally my apathy level. And I never even looked at my GPA until I was talking to my counselor in junior year. And she was like, well, if you want to go to aviation, you probably need to get your grade point average up. And I said, well, I mean, what is it right now? And she's like, well, it's like a 2.3 and I'm sure they want something higher than that. I said, yeah, that's probably a good point. So I don't think when I started, and it was something that I'm always of the mindset that if I'm going to do something, I'm just going to go and I'm going to do it. And I'm going to learn along the way. I'm going to stumble. I'm going to mess up, but I'm just going to go ahead and do it. And I haven't really looked at any of my past indicators or past performance to like kind of indicate what I think I'm going to do in the future. I really solely just focus on what I want. And then do it, because I'm a firm believer, and I've told this to every student I've ever had, that we have literally sent a monkey to space. Like we can train you to do anything. It's possible. It's tougher to train things like, you know, good decision making, good situational awareness. That's the stuff that we really, really get paid for. It's not the physical act of landing an airplane, although that is very important, of course. But that's why we solo you after 10 hours, right? If this was the hardest thing in the world to do is land an airplane, we wouldn't solo you first off. We would solo you at the very end, right when you're going to go get your check ride. So there's that mentality that I'm going to go into it. I'm going to probably mess something up along the way, but I learn from my mistakes as well as from my successes. So let's just go in and do it. And that's kind of how this book came about too, but we'll get into that a little bit later. So when I finally took my mom up on it, was like, yeah, can we go and, you know, see what it's all about? And do I go into, what do I need? I didn't even know there was such a thing as ground school. So I went into enlisted in ground school, took my first flight, and then, you know, went off and never really looked back. I just looked forward and then said, okay, well, I could have done a lot better my freshman and sophomore year of high school, but that's not what happened and I can't change it. So here's what I got to do to make it at least a little bit across the move the bar up a little bit. And that's all I focused on. And that's really, once I set into it, and there were certainly setbacks in that training, I was flying once a week, sometimes twice a week, all junior year into my senior year. And that's tough, right? That's tough to learn. that's not an ideal way to learn. Luckily I was younger, so it was easier to do, but, yeah, right now I couldn't imagine going out and, you know, oh, here's your type ride for the 7A. We're going to do one sim a week and then you're going to go home for a week. You know, that's not,
yeah, good luck.
Yeah, I'm never going to progress. So yeah, I don't think I was self-aware enough, or I was too determined to really think about that I might fail at it.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting, and this will be kind of the last question talking about your grades in high school, I promise. But you're not alone. Yeah, you're not alone, right? Like, there's people that just don't have their passion. And I mean, I wasn't a great student either. I love sports. So all I could think about was just trying to get to the NFL, trying to get to whatever professional sport league at that time that I thought I could make it. And I didn't care about it. I didn't care about academics as well. So they definitely suffered. I didn't have a 2.3, but I mean, it wasn't like good enough to get into UNC, which is like the really good local school, state school. So to you now, like, successful airline pilot, wrote a book, looking back, like, obviously your story shapes who you are and you go through everything, the adversity to kind of build you are to who you are now. But do you wish you could go back and tell, you know, younger you, like, hey, like, work harder, focus on grades? Do you think your life would have turned out any differently? Or is it just kind of like, it is what it is? Like, it's just who I am, part of my story.
My gut reaction is to say it is what it is. It's who I am. And, you know, but it's an interesting question. I get asked that more often than you think. And it happens a lot during low points. And I'm specifically remembering a trip, funny enough, in Moline, with a captain that I flew with, I still highly respect. We went to different airlines, but he had asked me a question at dinner in the middle of this trip. And he said, you know, knowing what we're dealing with in bankruptcy and looking at a merger and seeing all of your friends at other carriers upgrading and all this other stuff, you know, do you ever wish you could have gone back and done it differently? And I had that same sort of like, no, because that's not what's happening. Like, I could spend a lot of my life looking back and going, oh, I wish I had done that. I wish I had said this. I wish I could take that back. I could do this. But the most miserable people I meet in life are the ones who stew on that. And I guess I've decided early on that I just can't do that. And I don't know what I don't know what I have that makes me think that way. I don't think it's a conscious effort on my part. I think it's literally just what I do. You know, full disclosure, right now I'm doing this in my house that got hit by a tornado in July. Oh, it's structurally sound, so I'm fine. But like, I'm what? Just realizing right when we started this that the outlet I've chosen to plug my computer into is not charging my computer. That's currently still off on the circuit breaker panel. But the first thing that I did when I came out to the house, because of course I was on a trip, right? I wasn't home. It's not going to be easy. The first thing I did is I came into the house. I looked up and I said, okay, well, I got to clean off the air conditioner compressor. We got to get this. And everybody else is looking at me like, well, aren't you upset? Aren't you mad? I'm like, it's things, it's stuff. What can I do? I can't change a tornado's path. Here we are. Like, let's get things moving. Like, come on, get up and move. So, I don't know. But it's an interesting question because I think whenever I'm asked it, I get a chance to tell that story of, you know, would it matter? Would I be in a different place? Would I have gotten to my dream job 2 years earlier? Maybe. Would that have put me in the wrong position though right now? Maybe I would have chosen to take an upgrade and been in the wrong place at the wrong time, or I'd have taken another chance to be at this airline that's now suffering more than my current airline. Tomato, tomato, right? That's not the path I'm on. That's not where I'm at. So just do what I can and look forward, and that's all I can do.
So talk a little bit about your private pilot training. A lot of people kind of ask me what I struggled with. What was something that you struggled with, or what was something that was like super easy for you that you weren't expecting?
Super easy. I'll start with super easy. Cross countries, actually. I've always been a big nerd on maps and geography and stuff. So back in the pilotage dead reckoning days with no GPS, I actually did fairly good at that. The thing I struggled with was just something that I think I took with me in a philosophy for how I've trained people, but I was embarrassingly farther along in training than I should have been when my instructor came to the realization that I didn't really understand crosswind landings. And I'm going to give you a setup to how this worked. This was well after my solo. Like we were in the cross country phase, I'm pretty sure. And, you know, he talks to me about the crosswind. He goes, okay, we're coming in, you know, land. And it was a right crosswind from the south. I was landing on runway 10 at DuPage and I was coming in. It was a right crosswind. So it should be right wing down, you know, left rudder, stuff like that. Apparently up to that point, every other crosswind I had ever had was left wing down, right rudder. Oh, no. So coming off of my left side. So we land in this crosswind and I, you know, do my correction and I don't even know how bad this must have been, but we roll out and we clear the runway and he goes, "What the hell was that?" And I'm like, "What? That was a crosswind landing. It was great." He's like, "What? I'm soloing you and you don't understand the difference between a left crosswind and a right crosswind?" I'm like, "I just thought we always landed with the left," you know, and he lost his mind. We were taxiing in and I'm like, "Well, I didn't know any better." And so what that resulted is, so he was exasperated. Like he was just beyond himself. Like he was allowing me to solo and I didn't really understand this concept. So probably the most impactful flight lesson I ever had was the very next flight lesson. Obviously, we're going to deal with crosswind landings.
Yeah, obviously.
The instructor was another SIU grad. It wasn't my normal instructor. He did some charter stuff. So he was off on a trip and this other guy comes in and he goes, "All right, you know," Mahid told us, "you know, Dustin told me what you got to work on. Here's what we're going to do. The wind's coming directly out of the west. We're going to go to DeKalb, Illinois, and they've got a runway 2 and 20, and we're just going to go up, teardrop back around." And we just switched, you know, from left to right crosswind for the entire hour. And that I never had a problem with crosswinds ever since. But it was like a little bit of ground, a little bit of better discussion on aerodynamics. I mean, the time we talked about crosswinds was like well before, and this really highlights the difference in 61 training versus 141 training, because this was all, you know, during high school's 61 course. I was a great flight school, still a great flight school, very large one at DuPage Airport. And it highlights, all of my instructors were from the 141 world. They didn't really understand, or if they did understand, they really didn't have a lot of resources to help them at the time put all of their knowledge into a 61 course. They basically said, "Okay, well, you did the private pilot ground school, so you just know everything about being a private pilot. We're just going to go fly." So the ground schools were very small. We didn't really have anything that supplemented our training. And that, you know, the time we learned about crosswind landings was like a year before I actually applied it or was able to apply it in any practical setting. So by that point, I was well lost. Like I didn't remember what the theory was behind it, let alone, you know, how to actively utilize it. So I wouldn't say that was hard for me, but it was things like that, that you just like, that's the problem with doing this so spaced out. You don't have time to put into practice any this knowledge that you learned. So that was probably the hardest thing for me in all of my private training, was just the lack of consistency throughout it.
And also, I mean, that kind of goes to being an instructor too, right? Like you don't know what someone doesn't know. Like you can, someone can nail a left crosswind over and over and over again, and you would never in a million years think like they just can't handle a right crosswind. Like why would you ever think they couldn't do it? So it's one of the great things of being an instructor, which I'm sure we can talk about a little bit as your time as being an instructor as well. But it's just like, how do you prepare for that? You don't, unless it happens. And for you, thankfully, I mean, that everything worked out fine, but the good thing he was in the plane with you. It was like, "What the heck, dude? Where are you going? Go around. We're doing this again. Come on."
Yeah. I wish I could tell you that ended in a go around. I think it was one of those where I literally landed on the left line. I don't even know how it happened. I just remember his reaction to that moment. And I was just laughing.
Yeah. But how was your PPL check ride?
Bad. I'm glad you asked. That's the only, currently knock on wood, check ride I had ever failed.
Yeah, let's knock on wood there.
I did fail a stage check later, but this private pilot check ride, and there's a good lesson in this. So a month ago, you know, I've been accepted at SIU for aviation. I learned a hard life lesson about picking and choosing routes, I guess is what I would say. So I chose somebody for my check ride. Cause again, it was, you know, you just call a DP in the area and schedule a check ride. And I scheduled Santa Claus. He was well known to just pass everyone, blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, well, I'm a month away. I don't want to take risks. I'm going to schedule Santa Claus whenever he's got time. So I show up that day and not even prepare. I was in shorts and a t-shirt. Like I didn't know that I was supposed to dress up to impress the check airman. So anyway, I show up just like it was another check, you know, another, in my mind, it was just another day. I'm going to do what I've always done. And I'm going to just be within the PTS that I've studied for and be all that and ready to go. And as I showed up, the owner, my instructor wasn't there. The owner walks over to me and goes, hey, just to let you know, the owner of flight school, just to let you know, he's being watched by the FAA today. I'm like, okay, what does that mean for me? And they're like, well, usually that means that the instructor, the DPE check airman has passed too many people or failed too many people. It could just be a random spot check. The FISDO at that time was still located at DuPage Airport, or it just could be any million of a number of things, but more than likely the check airman is going to be on high alert today. And I said, okay, what can I do about that? Like, he goes, well, you can call in sick right now and hope they don't show up for it next time. Or you can take your chances. And I'm like, well, I'm ready. Like, you know, just let's go for it. You know, we get in there and I failed the oral on three questions. And I will never forget these three questions because they were
like the first three questions
legitimate. No. We were all the way done. In fact, I'll tell you what actually. Well, no. So this is the fun buildup. So the three questions and specific things that he cited on my pink slip was the first question is legitimate. I will hand him that. He asked me, do we need to be in the utility category and weight and balance to do stalls today? And what was kind of throwing me off, which is also going to affect the third question, is we had this FAA guy riding with us. And now that did throw off my weight and balance. And it put us, normally we were in this utility category on these very old Cessna 172s that had utility category. Most of them now don't, right? They're normal or you're out. They had this utility category. And I forgot that meant to spin the aircraft intentionally, we had to be in this utility section of the weight and balance. So I screwed that up, owned it. And he goes, oh, we'll read the notes. And I read the notes and I was like, oh no. Okay. It says here, we just need to spin it. We have to be in that envelope. Okay, fine. But that was still check off. The second question, we were on the theoretical cross country, you know, he's looking at my planning and he goes everything. And he goes, okay, you have an engine problem here. It starts sputtering and having an issue. And it's just, you know, point along this route. It's like right here. Well, where are you going to go? And I looked down at the map and Casa de Aero, it's a little private strip, but it's not restricted. It's just a little flying community. I said, I'm going to put it down right on that strip of pavement right there. And he goes, you're not going to look at anything? I said, no, I mean, I know it's private, but I mean, I'm going to use my emergency authority as PIC. I'm going to put it down right on that strip. I'm having engine problems, right? He goes, yeah, but you know, can't you find any other thing? And I'm like, I mean, I could turn around and go back. I can go here. I can go there. And he goes, well, how about you look up Rockford, Illinois in your AFD, back when it wasn't the chart supplement, it was an AFD. I pull out this green book and I look up Rockford. He goes, okay, is Rockford a good alternate? And I look at it and I go, well, yeah, I'm sure they're going to have services. Well, he goes, well, how do you know they're going to have services? And because they're a major airport. I don't know.
Like, I don't know, bro.
Fly there. What do you mean? What's the question? Delta? Like, yeah. I don't. So he goes, well, what does this S4 in a circle up at the top mean? I'm like, I have no idea. And at this point I'm a little flustered because I'm like, you're going to make me fly another 50, 60 miles on my flight with an engine problem when I'm right over an airport. Okay. So I was playing ball with him and he gets to this point where he's finally like, okay, well look it up in and so I look it up and it says, oh, S4 means major airframe, major power plant repairs. Okay, noted. I guess I can go there for engine problems. Yeah. Why wouldn't you go somewhere where you can get your plane fixed?
Because I have to fly 50 more miles.
Because that's literally yeah. What I told him. I'm like, because I'm going to have to fly further with an engine problem. And at this point, I'm looking over at the FAA guy in the room had been sitting like this with his mouth over his hand, just kind of staring at the floor most of the time. And at this point, he's looking at the check airman like,
is he really?
Dude, what are you doing? So anyway, I'm like, okay, I guess I can go to Rockford. And he goes, okay, great, we'll move on. So we get all the way to the end of this chat of the oral, and he gets to looking at my endorsements. And he notices that my crosswind endorsement is for 10 knots, you know, whatever, the normal endorsement up to like 15 knots steady state, 10 knot crosswind, something like whatever the typical endorsement was back then that they were giving us out of that flight school. And he said, well, I need to see an unrestricted endorsement prior to you flying. I said, why? And he goes, well, because I need to know that somebody believes that you can handle taking off and landing in any condition. I'm like, well, that's why I'm here. And he goes, okay, but like, I guess I need to ask you this question. Who's PIC of this flight? This was something I'd never heard about yet. Believe me, all of my students from here to eternity have known about it. I did not realize I was PIC of that flight. I thought, this was my mentality. I said, well, I know I'm acting as PIC. And that would be if you were here and I were here. But now we have this FAA guy here. And I don't think I would be able to act as PIC with this FAA guy here as well. And he looked at me and he goes, I need a moment to talk to this guy. No, actually, he didn't say that yet. He said, well, go outside and find somebody who's willing to endorse you, which nobody there at the time had flown with me in like months. And I'm like, yeah, I wouldn't expect anybody to want to endorse me for unrestricted when I'm going on my check ride. And I came back, and that's when he asked me this question about who's PIC. And I said, well, that's my mentality on it. And he goes, well, I don't feel comfortable with that answer. And at this point, we're going to have to stop the check ride. And I'm like, okay. Like I'm like, those were the three things he cited on my paperwork, was those three questions. And after that, and then, by the way, at this point, the FAA examiner is like leaning onto the table, staring at him, like, he goes, Andrew, can we have a second? He's like telling me to leave the room. And I'm like, yeah. And I walked out and I found the owner, and I'm like, yeah, he failed me. And he goes, and the owner loses his mind, and he walks in there and screams at him for a while, which I'm sure didn't help me at all. But I mean, it was already done. And I'm just kind of dumbfounded. And I'm like, that was the weirdest check ride ever. So ever since then, the moral of that story is I learned, you know, those three things. And then the other, well, I really didn't learn the second one. I still maintain that I would absolutely all day, every day, even now with a whole bunch of time, would still put it on that piece of pavement instead of fly to Rockford. But
it's probably cheaper for you to land at that private, or the private strip, truck it out, than to go land at Rockford and use the expensive mechanic.
And replace the seal or whatever was leaking, as opposed to doing permanent damage to all of my cylinders by flying an extra 50 miles with, you know, the wrong compression or no oil movement or something. Like, dumbest lesson I've ever not learned. But so that taught me also that, you know, not to shy away. Everybody, when you actually look at the FAA, you know, FISDO or the DPE pass rates, they're honestly pretty similar. People sometimes give DPEs certain reputations for being overly difficult or being very, very, or being Santa Claus in my case. In my experience, picking the easiest person has never worked. And that's, of course, off of one experience. So I don't ever where the cards lie, the cards lie. You know, if I get paired up with somebody who's supposed to be very, very difficult to work with, I just know that I got to go in there and keep calm and listen, hear them out, and just make sure I'm answering it to the best of my abilities, because even if I pick the easy one or the hard one, my chances are within about 10% difference between pass rates, because all of them hover between 70 and 90%. So like, or most of them hover between 70 and 90%. So you're going to already fall within the favorability of passing, and you're going to basically argue, you're basically going to make yourself feel better over like 10 to 20%. It's just not worth that. So that's what I tell all my students, is don't fear the person, just focus on you.
And I mean, anyone can ask you, like, you're not going to, I mean, you know a lot, right? But there's always a question that could lead anyone down a rabbit hole to fail a check ride. They could find a reason to fail you if they really wanted to. And I mean, your check ride seemed very unfortunate.
But, yeah, it is. And you know, is what it is. And I I've certainly had friends of mine that have had check rides that weren't unfortunate and they should have failed, and they've told me about. And I've had students who have failed check rides that were my fault. One of my CFI candidates is to date, by the way, the only failure on my record. But it was my fault. And I own that with him. Was I forgot to practice hood work with him. And it was just a regular CFI check ride, but I forgot that they do unusual attitudes in CFI. And we had never even done that, and he hadn't done it from the right seat. So the DPE goes and hands him the foggles and goes, all right, you know what's coming. And he's like, no, I don't. No, I don't. So that was, you know, that, you know, things, these things happen, right? So, you know, that was a difficult one to swallow, especially for me as I was going in batting perfect. But that's just how it is.
Well, it's another example that if you fail a check ride, your career is not over and you can still overcome it. And you can still get a job and you can still fly 787 for a major airline and go to cool places. So if you fail something, you'll be all right.
Just be honest about it. I can't tell you. It's this industry is so big and so small. And the amount of people that I have run into that have been honest about everything, that have failed multiple check rides, especially in their private, you know, their primacy level, private instrument commercial. I know there are some DPEs out there who will force fail CFI candidates because if they've never failed something up to that point, how are they going to be able to bond with their students if they haven't failed? It's a terrible mentality, yeah, by the way, and it's not right.
Please don't
do
that.
But I know that there are DPEs that have done that, and it's just insane. So, yeah, by the way, if that case, if this person has actively told people that they're doing that, yeah, that's one case where I would go to another DPE and not let my cards just play out. But that person has since had his letter pulled to do work.
There you go. Makes
sense.
Wonder
why.
Yeah, go figure. Let's take a break from today's episode and hear from our sponsor, RAA. If you're like me, you might wonder, am I saving enough for the financial future I want flying? That's when I check with RAA's free retirement paycheck calculator, and you'll want to as well. Based on a few simple financial factors, I get an instant snapshot of how much I could expect to receive each month in retirement. And if I'm falling short of my goals, adjustments I can make to get my savings strategy back on track. It's quick, easy, and free. Try it today at raa.com/pilot to pilot. And now back to today's episode. Shortly touch on, did you use the same DPE for your check ride again? Or did you choose it?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, I did.
Was the FAA there again?
No, funny enough, they were not there again. But the way that he did I remember this, it was $500, but he gave you two chances for $500. So that, and that was always his thing. It was, you know, he was upfront about that at the beginning before he knew the FAA was going to be watching him. And then I had known that going into it already because I was watching my money going into college. So, I was, you know, I'm like, well, at least I get a freebie, I guess.
thanks so. For the discount.
I wouldn't yeah, thanks. Free. Yeah, like, yeah. $250 yeah. $250 per ride now. Thanks.
Yeah. That's funny.
So, yeah.
So rest of your training, you choose Southern Illinois, you go there. Mm-hmm. Everything go pretty well. No failures, like you said. It was 141 style training for 61. So do you have a favorite? Do you wish you would have done everything 141? Or are you kind of happy you had the 61 instruction?
I'm glad I had the 61 instruction. It helped me with a few other things post-college. The 141, though, is excellent. I still recommend that to everybody. Obviously, nowadays with, you know, a lot of airlines pulling away from the college degree requirement, it becomes a struggle to emphasize the importance of having a higher education degree, which I still maintain is valuable. Even if you don't pair it up with an aviation major, pairing it up with something, because what that does more than high school is it teaches you how to learn, and it really teaches you how to synthesize complex ideas far more than you would if you had stayed just at that high school level, where high school kind of teaches you to learn, but it really teaches you about following rules. And college really shows you that, hey, you are able to make your own rules now. As long as you sit within the bounds of your job, which is your classes, you'd make your life. And it allows you to kind of have a safe space to do that and challenge sort of this structure that you've been given. And then I encourage everyone to go past that now and get their master's degree, because that's really truly self-taught and creating the next level of thought out of that as well. But with airlines not really requiring anymore this college degree or really caring as much, they still prefer it, and you will still get there faster if you have a college degree, but they're not going to limit themselves. And I'm okay with that. I'm certainly fine with that. I've flown with incredible pilots who did not have college degrees, and that's completely okay. But when I'm talking to a younger generation that's looking at maybe paths to travel, I tell them not to discredit going the college route.
Oh, for sure. And it's crazy that you don't have to go to college anymore to do it. I mean, it's definitely beneficial. Like, I'm sure it's another check in your box to get your application seen. But right now it is a hiring frenzy and it seems like they will hire a lot of people. So, I mean, it just is what it is. But you can't go wrong going to college. Like you said, you learn a lot about yourself. You learn how to, you're the one that has to get everything done on your own. Like, parents aren't there to drive you to school, make sure you're on the bus, whatever it is. You are all by yourself. You have all the time in the world to make decisions, whether they're good or bad. So definitely the way to look at that. Keep going.
Oh, I was going to say one thing too, that, and you don't have to, it doesn't have to be college. It can be a trade, but our medicals, right? Like, how many times have we talked to people who have medical issues that lose their livelihood or have to retire early or transition away from the industry because they weren't able to maintain their first class medical? And now with the way that the airlines work and their standards, you have to be able to maintain a first class medical the entire time you work there. So it's one of those things, you know, if you have a small medical issue, drop down to a second class, you can still make a living in aviation. But if you can't hold a medical period, you're not making a living in aviation, and or you're going to have to go to management, or you're going to have to do something else outside of that. But if you have some other training that allows you to supplement your life in case something like that happens, or we have another pandemic that shuts everything down, you know, that's another key reason to diversify your skill set. Now, pilots have a great skill set. We can time manage, we can manage complex tasks, we can multitask. We're great managers, and we're great managers of people. So a lot of pilots think, oh, all I have is this aviation thing, I don't qualify for anything else. That's not true. There's a lot of industry out there that do seek the type of management skills that pilot inherently have. So try to constantly have that backup plan in your mind. And then if you don't need it, great. But have something so that if something happens in your life, you're easily able to pivot on your heel and shift until you get your medical back.
Totally agree. Or if you don't get your medical back.
Or if you don't get
your medical back. But yeah, for you, when you're coming through, you are CFI. Well, I guess better question is, when you started your training, even as high school you, or even early into college, was your goal to become a major airline pilot? Like, did you have an airline set in mind? Did you have a path set in mind that you wanted to go down?
My path was corporate aviation. So I kind of alluded to this earlier. You know, there is nothing nicer than sitting in the back of a corporate jet. I think they are just the coolest, nicest rides out there. Had Wi-Fi way before this. Yeah, right. Yeah. they still are. And so after college, I graduated in May of 2009, which, you know, horrible time to graduate in this industry. And I was very, very fortunate that an alumni of SIU ran a major corporate flight department out of San Jose. And that was, at the time, they had 7 Gulfstream 5s. They flew all over the world. They had just merged with another major tech company in Dallas. So they actually had 2 locations with hangars. It was this incredible like operation. And I was very fortunate to be offered an internship position with them for 3 months. And I worked in the maintenance division day to day. And then I would go jump seat on these Gulfstream flights when I had the chance. So I went to Sun Valley, went to San Diego, flew McKinney, Dallas, Salina. We flew, because the Gulfstream holds 40,100 pounds of fuel in its wings alone. We flew over to Salina to gas up and then back to San Jose, because you're able to burn that amount of fuel in that little hop and still make a ton of money off of that quick little transition. So it was a really it was an amazing experience. It was an unbelievable experience to be able to intern there. And that was my plan. Coming out of there, after the internship, my boss said, you know, I can tell flying is where you're at. I, full disclosure, do not have the patience for maintenance. God bless all you technicians out there, because I lose my cool when, like, I can't, like, when it's just stripped enough, when the screw head's just stripped enough, I'm like, that's it, I'm done. This isn't meant to be taken apart. I'm not doing this anymore. So obviously my strengths are not, my patience is not in maintenance. I understand that. And my boss understood that and goes, go out, get your time. I can't hire you with 700 hours to fly a G5 all over the world. So you need to go out and get your time. So yeah, right. So then I left that internship, went back to Carbondale. Unfortunately, the semester had already started. So I worked at Best Buy, and then I took my double I and my, I wrote a couple papers. I had to get enough credits to get up to, part-time status so I could apply for student loans. So I did double I, which was one credit hour, wrote a bunch of papers that we did one paper per credit hour. And then I took a glass panel course because at the time we all had all steam gauges. We had a KLN 94. That was our big sexy GPS and no glass, but we had one simulator that had the G1000 in it. So I took that class, wrote three papers and did the double I. And in an interesting sort of twist of fate, The school was going through a horrible time. The state of Illinois is perennially broke and has always all types of issues. And what was happening was specifically higher education was having a very tough time getting their budget set. And our president at SIU at the time came out the day before they were meeting for staffing for the following semester, came out and was like, yeah, if we don't get an emergency influx of cash, we are not going to survive. So needless to say, the whole school in general was going to shut down. So needless to say, there was a hiring freeze everywhere. And I called up the chief instructor. I said, John, I'm guessing I'm not coming on next semester. He goes, no. He said, but I got a guy out in Ohio who runs the Ohio University flight program, and he needs double I's. So I've got you and another buddy of mine, Dave. I got you guys interviews if you want to go. I said, yeah, I got to go where the flying is, right? Like it's 2009. We're officially out of the recession, but climbing, but airlines are still, you know, on the heels of furloughs. It would be another year-ish before airlines started hiring. And I went and drove out there on November 30th. Met the couple of the instructors. I think we went up and did a flight so that they could see that I knew how to fly. That sounds like something you would probably want to know if you're hiring an instructor. And it was in a Piper Warrior. I had like 10 hours in Archers. Like that was it. So I was going to completely flip fleets. And they asked like two technical questions. The chairman kind of just speculated a bunch in the conference room. And then we did the one flight and then we left. And I started January 4th. And I worked there, rewrote a bunch of courses for them. They were looking for outside, you know, kind of perspective into the program. Rewrote a bunch of their courses, did help with the help of one of their other alumni who's super sharp guy, still one of my best friends. And then worked there all the way, helped coach their flight team, did all this other stuff. And was a check instructor and then left there when the airlines finally started hiring again. And I went to American Eagle Airlines at the time, which no longer exists on paper, but now called Envoy, and went there until I went to my current employer in 2018. But yeah, that's sort of, but really honestly, back to your original question, my path was corporate. And so when I went to, I had to go where the flying was because I had to get my time to go back to my intern company. And I took my job at Eagle because I had to go build time in jets. And that was the fastest way to build time was at the airlines at that point. So I went there. And then what happened to change that course? One is I liked the schedule. I realized, mind you, when I went to the airlines, I was ready to be disappointed. I was like, this is going to be a miserable experience, especially at the regional level. I'm not excited to be here. I'm excited to fly a jet, but like, this is going to be, you know, it's not going to be fun. I was ready for it to be miserable. And I, the more and more I was able to get into the world of it, I was like, I do like the structure. I do like the schedules. I don't mind the airplanes. I like the travel benefits. I don't get to keep the mileage or the hotel points. I know all of you are all, you know, platinum members at Hilton or someplace. So it's nice. I mean, that part of it was nice. And really what ultimately kept me there and two things simultaneously happened. One, unfortunately, the normal thing or an all too common story out of corporate aviation is the CEO changed. The next CEO came in, did enjoy flying, but that CEO tried to radically change the company in like in a bad way, very, very bad way. And their stock tanked. He was promptly fired and their current CEO got installed. And the current CEO saw that as a liability, From the seven G5s they had, they split the company back in two, which is funny because the two companies they split it into were the merged companies that I came into. So it's kind of like, well, you're just reversing what you did. So they reversed that. They split off two sections and now there's only one G5 per, well, they're onto the 550s now, or even, I think they've got an order for the 600 or 700, whichever one is supposed to replace the 550. They've got so, but now they're only down to two airplanes, and I think I only know one or two people there. Everybody else went. So the director wound up leaving to go to another major, very large flight department when he saw the writing on the wall with what the direction of the board wanted. So sadly, I don't even think they have that hangar anymore. It was a beautiful hangar. They built it back in the 70s or 80s. Yeah, at one point, this flight department was the largest flight department. I'm pretty sure was the largest flight department before Walmart came in and, you know, took over the world.
With their, you know what else is crazy is if this was, so say this was all happening, you had that internship right now. The owner or whatever, whoever it was, chief pilot's like, hey, you only have 700 hours. We can't hire you. That's not true anymore. They'd be like, you have 700 hours? Come on in. Let's go. You're also going to probably make like 100 grand. You're going to get this great job. We need you to stay here, please.
100%.
So it's just timing, right? So like if you would have been 4 years later coming up in this career, you might still be there. You or who knows, maybe not. But you could have taken the corporate route a little bit longer.
Exactly. And I was hook, line, and sinker with it. I still love that, right? That's still a facet that I very much enjoy. I definitely don't think there's like a, you're either airline or you're corporate. And there's a ton of airline pilots that are retiring now that are going back to corporate because they're not done. And they want to be able to continue to fly and they want to, for any myriad of reasons, or they've always wanted to fly the sexy corporate jets that, you know, you don't have to wait for edict times unless you're going to Teterboro. You don't have to do anything like, you know, you're going from here to there and you're going to go and you're not going to have to wait for the gate agent to start boarding or for the flight attendants to finish, you know, their checks and stuff like that. You run the operation, and pilots are so type A normally that we love that aspect of it. So I could turn around and go corporate tomorrow and I could be completely happy with my career, honest to God, because I do enjoy what that offers my personality.
Yeah.
So
I was going to ask you that as you're taking on like now airline, your friend Julia, who's been on the podcast before, like we talked about, you see her talk about her corporate, you see her corporate career. I mean, it'd be crazy to say that you wish you were still corporate based off new contracts that have come out. You're flying a 787. You're probably not working that much right now. So like looking back on it, are you happy how everything played out, or does a part of you still wish that you would have stayed corporate and kind of like follow that path?
I think I would have been happy either way that played out, honestly, because I, you know, honestly, my earnings at this point would be probably about even, because like you said, I would have been making a lot more money early on. And you can take that, you can transfer that a lot easier. You know, so many of the people, airline pilots that develop this sort of overly bitter personality tend to do that from a perspective of, well, this is my 14th airline, and every time I had to restart over at the bottom. So even though you're making decent money at the top, if you constantly have to restart at the bottom, you're not making that money. And it takes you forever to actually build up a stable lifestyle where you're 50% up the seniority list and you're pretty insulated from any of the changes that might be occurring in the industry, in the macro and micro environment, global environment. Whereas in corporate aviation, you can take that skill and be like, well, I have 5,000 hours in Gulfstreams or Hawkers or Bombardier. This is how much I was making. What do you think? And they go, yeah, okay. And not to mention, I think BCA still does it, or I forget the company who does it, but there is a yearly assessment of the average fees that you're making as a pilot for in all the different types of aircraft. You have a different negotiating power than you do at the airlines, where one union speaks for you and your value versus you who speaks for your value and your exact experience. You can translate that. So I think it's sexy to look in the moment and say, wow, look how much these signing bonuses are. Look how much I can make as a 787 pilot. But I started making $20,000 a year. And then my next year was 30. And then the next year after that was 60. Whereas if I had started out at a far more lucrative sector, such as corporate, you know, who knows? And that's all going to keep up, right? I think corporate is the more in some ways a more stable environment. Even though you may change jobs a lot, you have the ability to keep your seniority, so to speak.
Certain places. So like the corporate I'm at, no, right? So we're one union, right? So if I was to leave, I'd kind of be going back to the bottom. But I do have that kind of corporate experience. So maybe I could find a similar airplane, that kind of thing. I already have my check ride, the hype rating, all the above. So yes. Mm-hmm. But there are instances where there's still one union. And even back then, probably two. Corporate probably wasn't making as much. It was probably more than your 20 grand, but they weren't doing, and it was still like who you knew, right? So, but yeah, no, I mean, it's difficult to make that decision for someone, right? Like you can always look back and be like, man, I wish I would have done that. Or even in my case, be like, man, I wish I was doing what you're doing. Because like 787, that's one of the, when we would be in San Francisco, we'd be over at Signature and I'd see a United 787 taxi by. I'm just like, dang, that plane's sick. Like I would love to go fly that plane. That was like the first plane, the first airline, the first airliner that made me kind of wish I was an airline pilot. But, mm-hmm. you know, grass isn't always greener, right? I like flying Latitude. I like flying corporate jets. It just is what it is. So,
you know what? That's funny because I've been in the 7-8 when we've seen a really awesome corporate jet taxi by. Usually it's the G650 or something
for sure.
along that line.
People don't look at the Latitude and wish they flew it. I get it. It's cool.
What's the one bigger than the Latitude?
Longitude.
Longitude. That's the one that like people look at and go, what is that? You know, but even the Latitude's got same similar lines and everything, but you'll see like, you'll hear those same types of envy comments and it goes to that grass is always greener, right? Like, oh, I bet you they actually got steak for dinner tonight. And I'm like,
sometimes.
Yeah, probably did. Yeah,
sometimes. That's a good shot. We also, a good chance we get food poisoning from some of our catering too. So there's that, but.
But same.
Yeah, that's same. True. Good point. Yeah. That's a kind of interesting question and we don't have to talk about it too much, but I always find it interesting when, let's say you're in 787, you got your captain there. How many times do they know what the small jet is? Are they like, hey, what's that? Like, can they tell what a Gulfstream is? Can they tell what a Global is or a Latitude, or is everything just a citation?
They know what a Gulfstream looks like.
Yeah.
And then they know what the Citation 10 looks like.
Yes. Oh my gosh.
Everything else after that is a, what is that? And don't even put a Westwind in front of them. They'll be like, what is this new airplane? That's, I'm like, that's an 80s airplane. Like that's round aisles in there. Like it's barely a turbo fan. Yeah. But it's very, very, very often they have no idea what they're looking at. And they'll just, and that's why you hear ATC at the big, busy airports go, your traffic's off in front of you, follow them. They won't even give the type because their chances are the captain's just going to start going like, no, I don't see it. Yeah. We're going. It's like, what are you talking about? It's that thing. Of course, logic of like deductive reasoning. They'll be like, well, that's the only thing. Yeah. I don't know what it is. And there it goes. So we're going to follow that.
Let's follow that. What's funny is though, is they could probably have a seven different 737s. They'd be like, well, that's a dash nine. That's a 800. That's a whatever. They could probably list all those. Be like, well, that one has six less windows. So that means that's a this. And it's like, ah, come on.
I think you're giving them a little too much credit.
All right, cool. We'll stop there. We'll stop there. Yeah.
I was an aircraft rec nerd when I was in college.
Oh, and you're one of those.
So I know. Yeah. That was one of my competitive classes, or not classes, but that was one of the competitive things I did for flight team. And I still love that event, but I'm the one who usually goes, there's two sets of brakes in the plane, right? So they'll say, follow the 7-6 and a 7-5 will go by, and then you'll see them click off the parking brake, and you're like, no, that's a 7-5. You're looking for that thing over there. That's a 7-6 that's actually coming around the corner. And they're like, oh, they look the same. Like, you have a type rating in that airplane. What do you mean you don't know what that looks like?
They actually don't. Like, one's a pencil and one's very big.
I know, but you'd be amazed how often that gets confused. It's really weird how that has a problem. But yeah, I know.
Yeah. Is what it is, right? This is, yeah. So you making your transition, this will kind of tie into your book here, making your transition, you are college graduate, you know, you did your whole thing. You got hired by Envoy, American Eagle, whatever you want to call it now. How difficult of a transition was that? Was that like going from high school to college? Was that going from like algebra to calculus? How was that transition? And was that what inspired you to write this book, or was other people's stories that kind of inspired you?
It's good. That's two-parter. So the first, this was, you know, first airline training, and then you pair that up with your first jet training and the first type rating experience. So there's a whole lot going on. I will say that one thing that that happened sort of simultaneously. As I was getting hired, the rules were starting to come into clarity of every airline pilot, every 121 pilot needing a type certificate. Prior to that, we were only getting SIC certificates. So initially I got my SIC, and then within 1 year, a year and a half, we had to come back and we got our full type rating certificate. And I'll go into a little bit of that probably later. But initially, I came from an environment, the way SIU taught everything was they want you to build the airplane. And that was their mentality, was that the airlines are going to make you build this airplane. So when we learned in the 310, which was our primary multi-trainer, and then I also flew a 421 for about 100 hours as part of our charter program, they wanted you to build the airplane. And so I went into the airline believing that I had to build this airplane. And what wound up happening, and at the time, and I can't speak to how it is now, but we were doing non-AQP training. We were doing the old school 121 method. And it was, basically, we're going to give you all this information. We're going to repeat it to you like once, and then you're going to go home and repeat it to yourselves by 50 times. And you're going to come back and regurgitate it to us. And that was kind of how that training went. And at the time, they were like, okay, I need you guys to know your limitations. Memory, your required limitations. You have to be familiar with your other limitations. You need to know your memory items. And then you have to know, here's a packet of systems questions. So it was very straightforward. But what they wanted us to do more than anything was study in groups. And that is not how I study. I do not study in groups. I much more prefer to make, and I still do it for planes I fly today. I will make a PowerPoint slideshow, that's what it's called. I'll make a PowerPoint deck where I will go and I will put a question down, or I'll put a flow where I've like wiped out all of the calls except for like the boxes. And then I will sit there and look at the blank one and redo it, and then advance, see if I got it right, and do it old school. I'll chair fly. I'll do a couple other different things that I've really done since I started airline training. But I always was good at just doing that by myself. And the reason that airlines want you to study in groups or study in pairs at a minimum, and AQP has kind of moved away from groups because a lot of our systems are one-on-one now. But when we used to study in 30 people classrooms and then take the test together, the power of studying in groups was that you were able to hear multiple viewpoints multiple times. And I mean, I remember the day before my oral at my new hire class, or for new hire training, we were studying the night before in a room with the kind of mini study group that we had formed. And somebody asked a question. I'm like, oh, I don't actually know that answer. Well, I got asked it the next day. And that was never in my slide deck. That was never in anything that I had prepared for. And that was the power of studying in groups. But they gave us a lot of really interesting like tidbits and factoids about how to study that really, really helped other than that. And we talk about a lot of those little tips in the book. One of the things that helped me a lot was taking a ball. And even if I don't have a ball today, I'll like crumple up a piece of paper and toss it in my hand and recite memory items, recite flows, recite profiles. And the reason that works is because when you're in the plane, right, you're doing something with your hands and you're doing things that your brain is telling your hands to do in a very coordinated fashion, whether you're really thinking about it or not. And if you're trying to catch a ball in your hand or bounce a ball against the wall while you're doing this, you're training your brain to tell your hands to do something while your brain is thinking of the information at the same time. And that alone has helped me study. Again, I still use this to this day. And they were telling us to do that way back, you know, at the very beginning of everything. So, I would say that it was a fire hose, but it's manageable if you focus on the very, very, the things that they tell you need to know. You need to know these things cold. Everything else will get you there on, because it can be a much more discussion-based based thing. So while that was, but to answer the second point of that question, yeah, that was a very important thing. And there are resource guides out there. There are things like that to kind of hint at how to study for these things. What was, I think, most important So the name of the company that we started is called VATH Publishing. VATH actually stands for Veteran Airline Transition Handbook. Richard, the lead author of our book, was an F-15 pilot. And when he retired from that, he went to, at the time, they weren't, you know, you didn't go to a major airline when he retired. Like, you went to a regional airline and you did the flow that everybody's sort of used to. So he went to Air Wisconsin, eventually went into the union track. His doctorate or equivalent of doctorate in the military is in union. I'm not going to do it justice, but it's in like structured organization management type of thing. And his specific dissertation was on union leadership. And so he went on to be the MEC chairman for Air Wisconsin. He's done a lot of other big volunteer work at ALPA National, the Airline Pilots Association, the big national organization. And that's how Richard Yolanda, our other author, and I had actually met. Richard was chairman of the pilot development group. Yolanda was membership chairman of all of membership of ALPA. And I was a National Education Committee member. And when I got hired at my current airline, who they also work for, I flew a trip with Richard and Yolanda was my IOE instructor. And we had eventually, through flying with them a couple of different times, we all kind of came upon this realization that we wanted to start a company, that this idea that we'd always had, which was to help fast track everything else in this industry right now, is fast tracked. You can, you know, how many companies out there are telling you that you can start from zero to airline in a year, and telling you you're somehow going to fly 1,000 hours in a year and a half, or, you know, you're like, oh my God, like, I couldn't even imagine that. And what we were realizing is that there is a resource and a need, because you're not learning at the pace to gain experience. You're learning to get past the check ride, and you're not learning anything else. And everybody else is like, you'll figure that out later. You'll figure that out.
That's what IOE's for. You'll be fine.
Yeah, that's what IOE's for. IOE, especially at our carrier, but at other carriers, focuses again so much on reinstalling all of the 121 regulations and airline and airplane specific things that they don't really have time to tell you how to bid, tell you how to be on reserve, tell you how to non-rev travel, tell you how to use aeromedical resources, tell you what the union is. There's just not enough time on the planet to do that. And so the reason that we started this was, Richard, we were having this meeting about how to help pilots, and Richard goes, well, what do you guys, you know, Andrew, you went through NDOC recently. What do you think is the most needed resource? And I'm like, well, quite frankly, there's no resource for military pilots. I was sitting in class and they would throw up something about the maintenance equipment list, minimum equipment list, but aircraft maintenance log. And they would flash it up there. They'd be like, this is it. This is what an MEL sticker looks like. This is an MEL. Follow the instructions and you'll get it. And you're like, I was like, but that's it? That's all you're going to tell me about this? And I was sitting next to two military pilots who did not go to the regional airlines. And at the end of the lecture, they turn to me and they go, what? And I'm like, yeah, that was a terrible job explaining to this. But that's kind of the airlines don't really need to tell you that. They're like, you have a book for that. Read the manual, right? Like, that's kind of the adage, is read the manual. You'll figure it out later. And we think that is a terrible way to teach people, because there's so much information in that manual that doesn't apply. So ironically, we settled on, well, originally this was a handbook. It was the Veteran Airline Transition Handbook. And what eventually morphed into that is, we were dealing with a consultancy firm who does a lot of work with hiring pilots and interview prep. And we gave them the first copy of the book and they had read it and they came back and they're like, no, every single person needs this if they're going to the airlines for the first time. They're like, don't pigeonhole yourself into just the military pilots. This is going to be critical for them, but you need, everybody is going to benefit from this because there's nothing like it. You touch on everything from how the airlines are structured, to how to apply, to how to get interviewed, to how you interviewed, to getting to onboarding process, training, institutional knowledge, dealing with the different airports that you're going to go to 50 times, but somehow never are a master of, dealing with our philosophy across the industry that is not really taught so much as like, well, you'll get it later. The amount of times, and then you'll pair that up with our union background. So I was a representative at Envoy before I left for my current employer, and we and Yolanda dealing with membership, Richard as his MEC chairman passed, we saw a lot of pilot problems, especially in the first year. And in the first year, you don't have the ability, the union doesn't have the ability to grieve your termination. After your first year and you're off probation, you're a dues paying member. Yeah, we'll write the $20,000 check to have the arbitrator come in and we'll fight your case for you because it's your livelihood, it's your life. And most of the time you're just really, you've stepped on the wrong toe or something like that. And what we did, what we saw was there were so many new pilots that were getting in trouble and losing their jobs simply because nobody took the time to explain to them how this works. And nothing more often got people in trouble their first year than non-rev travel, of all things, giving your family passes and then having your family scream at the gate agent that they didn't get a seat will get you fired faster than anything in an airline. Just
can FYI. You imagine? You make it to the big leagues and then your mom or your dad yells at someone and you fire. Like,
yeah, I put the fear of God into them. When I first gave out these passes, I was like, you don't tell anybody the gate agent will know, but if you're anything but less than polite, I can be mean, but you can't be mean. Like, and I'm never mean, but I have a better chance of coming out of this unscathed if I come across as rude versus you. And exactly. They don't even ask for a second opinion. They're like, your parents were rude. At best, they're going to lose their travel privileges. At worst, you're going to get fired. And all it takes is like one little thing, right? Like maybe you had to repeat a couple lessons in training. Maybe you had to you failed your oral, which again, you're not going to get dismissed for that. But there's like a pattern here. You missed a couple of your assignments. You know, that's another thing that'll get you fired real fast is if you miss an assignment in your first year. Mostly at the regional airlines. Major airlines won't fire you for that. There's way too much investment in you, but a regional airline, if they start seeing things like this pop up, their philosophy is, oh, that's just going to indicate you're going to be a problem in the future, which is nonsense, but that's the mentality that they take.
Well, so, to be fair, they could always fill it with someone else immediately, right? Like, it's just like, all right.
They're having more trouble with that. Yeah. But they also know. Yeah. Like, and honestly, some of the, you know, even now, if you get released from one airline, usually you can see the writing on the wall. Good union representative will usually know that and advise you just to resign immediately. But still, like, you know, there should never be in that position. If you really wanted to go work for this airline, you shouldn't be at a disadvantage because nobody told you what the pitfalls are. And that's really what this book was born out of, was how do we help people who have zero experience in the 121 world operate in the world. There's plenty of books about how to fly a jet, how to fly in an airline environment, but there's nothing about being an employee of an airline, which is very weird. It's very different. And there's like 85 different things that you need to think about just to keep yourself off of the radar. And really, it's not that hard to do. But you got to know. You got to know what the pitfalls are. So a lot of this book is informed by all of the people we saw get in trouble for things that are just absolutely ridiculous, that should never be a problem, but they were never told that that was a thing. So that's where most of this book's sort of philosophy was built from.
Do you have a section in there that's like, all right, if you're in contract negotiations, you have to be even more on top of your game because they like to take hostages and make examples.
We have an entire chapter on unions, and that is definitely a discussion about Section 6 negotiations, which is, you know, what you're alluding to. Yes. That's about all I'll say about that. One of the other things I like talking about in that too is we have a spouse chapter. That came out. It's written to the spouses, but we always, recommend that y'all read it together because even different, and we see this even as military pilots transitioning out, there's a different mentality when you're in the military and being on deployment versus this weekly deployment. And the original, I think we're working on addition to slightly in the background, but the title of that chapter is The Weekly Deployment, because it's a different sort of contract where you're like, well, you know, if you're on reserve, you may not fly at all. And then if you're a line holder, I have my schedule there. Why do you have to go out every week? Can you just do like 2 weeks on, 2 weeks off? How's your rotation work? And a lot of times it's just different. And a lot of times too, there's life after the military where you're like, okay, I'm no longer going to be deployed for a year, but then they don't realize that also means they're going to be gone, you know, 3 days a week. So there's a really interesting chapter that we all kind of wrote based on our experience, based on other spouses' inputs, that talks about how to deal with that while you're adjusting to this lifestyle. So we felt that was important. There's a lot of chapters like that you just don't have. There's no resource out there to deal with. We do have a foreign pilot chapter that deals with transitioning with your E-1B. I think I'm going to screw that up. I didn't write that chapter. We had a pilot who had just made the transition document her experience and then informed us on that chapter because we were not in the best position to speak intelligently on that. So when you can't, you find somebody who can. And she did a great job of explaining all that process. So, yeah.
So for someone who, let's say they're listening right now, they're interested in this book, they're getting ready to go to Republic, Envoy, maybe they're skipping them all. They're going straight to the big leagues. You know, they're going to the big three plus Southwest, FedEx, UPS, whatever it is. Mm-hmm. Where do they go? How much is it? What can they expect out of it?
So there's a couple of different places. We have a distributor who does, who handles our, we're going to call it final copy of the book, that our full print edition. And that's Malavolti Pilot Shop. The easiest way though, and our website will get you to everything, is airlinetransition.org. Not .com. Apparently airlinetransition.com was taken, but .org isn't. So airlinetransition.org. We do have a cheaper option there as well while supplies last. We had advanced reader copies that normally get sent out to people that are interested in like buying bulk, but we have enough of those left over that we're selling those for $24.99 right now until we run out of them. And once they're gone, they're gone. We're not reprinting those. And then we have an ebook. Caution about the ebook. If you buy the ebook, it's a one-time, one-shot deal. So you're going to pay for it. Try to pay for it on whatever platform you're going to use. If you accidentally screw that process up, email us. We'll send you another link. No harm, no foul, but just saves you a lot of heartache. So airlinetransition.org, or if you head over to Malavolti Pilot Shop, it's the first thing that comes up on his website. We're on the front runner of it because he's our distributor. So,
You need to get a union to like buy them all, you know, like so they hand it out to all the new hires.
We've worked on it. There's stuff going on in the background because that's ultimately what we would like to do. Yeah. We would like to have that be not something that they need to burden with themselves with, because we believe it's a required resource. So we might one day not have to work on the sales pitch anymore and just have it naturally in there.
So. Well, here's the podcast. Hopefully that'll help, you know, just scoot right in. Yeah, we'll be good. Well, Andrew, those are pretty much all the questions I have for you, man. I know. I had a lot of fun talking. Hopefully, I know you mentioned a tornado hit your house. That's still like, I still can't get that out of my mind right now that you just like casually brought up a tornado hit your house and now we just talk for an hour and a half. But it's been great having you. I look forward to this episode coming out. So it'll be a lot of fun. And congrats on all the success in your personal life and the book. And it's been great talking to you, man.
Same. Thank you for having me, Justin. Appreciate it.
That's a wrap on today's episode. Thank you so much for listening. I haven't said this in a while, but you know, if your little brother's over there, your brother, sister, whatever, just grab their phone, subscribe to the Pilot the Pilot podcast. Maybe they'll become a pilot. You'll never know. Navy Nation, that's all I have for you today. So as always, happy flying.